Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, April 27th, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar for today. We did have a little bit of time in between the last hearing and the next one. So that is why we were off camera. We realized that both of you joined a little bit early, and we appreciate that. But we want to make sure that any observers or any other people who wanted to join, knowing that this was set for 10:10, we wanted to wait for approximately that time. So thank you for your patience. We are holding this via zoom.gov. So we are holding these oral arguments today virtually. They are being recorded. No other recordings are allowed. We appreciate you participating in this manner. If we do run into any technical difficulties, which does occur from time to time, we'll make sure that we address them at the time so that each party has the opportunity to participate fully in our oral arguments. We do have a clock. The marshal has a clock up there that will display the time, 15 minutes for appellant's initial arguments, followed by 15 for respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant if you so choose. All other rules of decorum, other than the fact that you don't have to worry about standing, will be followed by this court. And I think that is about it. We will now proceed with the appellant's attorney. If you can please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel Tom Atmore, on behalf of the relator Samira Hussein. We're here today on appeal from a decision of an unemployment law judge that affirmed Deed's determination of a change in eligibility and denial of benefits going forward. And it was based on a reading of Minnesota Statute 268.086 Subdivision 7, and that subdivision relates to wage credits and eligibility for benefits between school terms. And there are two issues presented here for decision. First, does that statute and subdivision require a finding that relator became ineligible for benefits that she was already receiving simply because of a change in a break in the school term, even though her unemployment status didn't change? And two, should the ULJ have granted a request for reconsideration and a new hearing, given some of the confusion that was apparent from the transcript and the lack of analysis of the statutory application? So our point today is that Subdivision 7 simply cannot apply to stop benefits for Ms. Hussein. And if you accept Deed's position here today, you have to conclude that the legislature intended to cut off future benefits simply because an employee had more than one job with the institution. In other words, they're punishing the industrious employees, but they did not intend, the legislature, that same result if the person only had one job and lost that job through no fault of her own. The legislature
Mr. Atmore?
Yes.
Yes, if I could stop you there, I'm a little confused by that argument because the statute says nothing about whether an employee has more than one job. And so but I think really my understanding of the issue is whether or not what job or jobs she had in the prior academic year, which would, and that's the focus. And then in terms of what position that she has been offered for the following academic year. And for the prior academic year, my understanding of the record is she only had one position at that time, and that was a community advisor. 2 years prior, she did have community advisor and tech support, but in the year in question that we're looking at, she only had the community advisor position.
So that's correct. And that, okay. I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
Yeah. So why is it that Deed error then if they just applied the statute of looking at the position that she had that year And that year that they needed to look at, she only had one position, the community advisor position.
Well, and that goes directly to our point, and that is, what does employment mean in Subdivision 7? Do you look at any employment, all employment, or do you look at each specific job and decide? So if you read Subdivision 7.1, which says that the applicant had employment for an educational institution in the prior academic year or term, and you look at it in terms of employment meaning one job, then as to the tech job, she did not have that in the prior academic year. And so 7.1 would not apply at all. In other words, the legislature can't have intended that somebody who had two jobs and loses one is suddenly cut off for benefits despite no change in unemployment status. Unemployment is defined in 268.035 subdivision, I believe it's 26, and it refers to the number of hours you're working, and there's a threshold. So she didn't, her unemployment status did not change in any period of time since she was laid off from the tech support job. So our point is, you need to focus on the employment as each job. And as to the tech job, 7.1 doesn't apply.
So, Mr. Atmore, if I may, I mean, I understand what you're saying about, you know, focus on each job. Mm-hmm. And I might very well agree with you if you're talking about the summer of, I think it's 2020, when she went from having two jobs, and as I understand it, in that spring semester to in the fall semester only having one job. But we're not. We're talking about the summer of 2021, right? And that's where she went from having one job with the university to having in the spring semester to being offered one job in the fall. And that seems to me to lead to a very different reading of the statute here. Could you help me with that?
Right. So here's again, if the issue was the CA job, the community advisor job, yes, I would agree with you that she was offered that job for the fall. And if she claimed unemployment benefits as to that job, then because she decided not to take it, then yes, she wouldn't be entitled to them under the statute. But how can it possibly make sense that when you lose a job in the 2 years prior, and you're entitled to benefits, that they suddenly stop, even though no change in unemployment status has occurred? This statute can't be read to mean that. It would be an absurd result, because there has been no change in unemployment status for this individual.
So is the key question then whether we're looking at unemployment status or at her employment status at the university, right?
Well, and that's why I say we need to focus on each job, and why this statute has to be, subdivision has to be read as to each job, because there are other provisions in 268 that have to be read in conjunction with this, including the definition of unemployment, including the definition of non-employment in, non-covered employment in 268.035 sub 20, suitable employment in 268.035.23a, and even in the definition of initial eligibility in 268.05 subdivision 1.3, you cannot say that this statute, subdivision 7.1, applies to cut off eligibility that you've already earned. Because
but Mr. Atmore, this statute, subdivision 7, is it's a carve out. It's a special provision that only applies to employees of educational institutions. So this is kind of a unique situation. There's specific language that applies in situations like this, and I don't think that's in dispute. And under this provision, employees cannot use their wage credits as a basis for to receive unemployment benefits when between breaks during academic years, if they have been given a reasonable assurance of resuming their employment that they had. So the way I read the statute, this subdivision, it talks about employment. It doesn't talk about unemployment. It's focusing on what employment they had before the summer break. What employment did they have? And she had the CA position. Did she receive a reasonable assurance of that in the fall for the coming academic year? She did. So I'm struggling as to how it sounds like you're trying to read in a provision to allow read in something that subdivision needs to look at unemployment, but this is really looking at what employment the person had.
Well, I appreciate that, Judge, but you have to read the entire statute and the entire chapter consistently and make the provisions harmonize. And it is correct.
This is an exception. This is a carve out, a provision.
It is.
And so it's like reading the statute saying this will happen unless or except in this situation, here are the rules. So where I'm struggling as to how you're reading in that language.
Right. And so let me explain. So the purpose of this provision is that when there is no real unemployment going on, in other words, the person has the job in the prior academic year and either has the job offered or has taken the job for the subsequent academic year, there is no unemployment. And so this statute says, we're not going to let you get unemployment benefits for that. You have a job, okay? We're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole here because she did not have that job. That job is the tech job. And she was earning...
If I can stop you there, Mr. Atmore, yes. It sounds to me like you're trying to read this provision to look back, not just at the current academic year, but you want to look back even further than that to prior academic years of what jobs she had and that she lost. Where in this subdivision 7 does it allow Deed to look back further than just 1 year?
The issue is, what does it mean when it says employment? That's where I want to focus. And you'll note that Deed pointed out that the statute changed in 2017. And they took out the modifier any that came before employment. That word was eliminated. So how do you read the statute consistently? You can't read this subdivision 7 in isolation. You have to read it in conjunction with all the statutory provisions. And so my point is, she had employment, the CA position, yes. She did not have employment, the tech support position, in the prior academic year. So you don't even get past subdivision 1 as to that job. And so it's an issue of how you read the word employment. What does that mean? And can you make it consistent with everything else in 268? And the only way that you can do that is if you say, did her unemployment status change in some way, or did her employment status change in some way? And the answer is, her unemployment status did not change. She remained unemployed from the tech job, and her employment status didn't change. She kept the CA job, or at least was offered it. And it would make no sense. Why would the legislature want an employee who was eligible and receiving benefits and had no change in their status, no change, to be suddenly cut off. It doesn't make sense. It's an absurd result. It's also an absurd result if you say someone with two jobs loses one and then keeps the other, doesn't get benefits. But if a person with one job loses it, they do. It does not make sense to read the statute so broadly as to say any employment at all. So, because you get the case we have today.
Mr. Atmore, if I may. Okay, yes. So I hear you saying, look, this exception doesn't apply at all because she didn't have, it's not addressing a situation where she had employment from one academic year to another or had employment from one and then lost it. This is this unique situation, so we don't apply. Okay, so looking at the plain language of this provision, are you saying it's unambiguous? Because I hear you saying it would be absurd otherwise. Now, we only get to whether something's absurd if we're construing a statute that is ambiguous. So could you just, and I understand,
right.
Judge Reyes, hopefully you can give him a little time to answer this question. So I just want you to tell me, is subdivision 7, is it ambiguous or not? And give me that short explanation because we don't get the absurdity argument otherwise.
Well, whether or not, I guess it is ambiguous to some extent because my point is you have to read it in conjunction with all the other provisions and the definition of unemployment and everything else. On the other hand, I just read employment to mean job because I think that's consistent with what else you find in 268, that it talks about jobs. And so, I can tell you that I read it and I think it's clear and it doesn't apply here, but I can see where reasonable minds might differ. And that's ambiguity. And if you have that ambiguity, then let's go to each of the other sections that I've mentioned in my brief and here today. And you'll see, I think, that if there's no change in unemployment status and job is what we're talking about, then you have to look at employment in the statute to mean the job. What job are we talking about? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Atmore. And we will, I actually had the same question, so I appreciate your answer and your response to that. We will give you 5 minutes for rebuttal after we hear from respondent's attorney, who will have 15 minutes. There's the clock indicating that you have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record, the party that you're representing, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Manoza Humayun, and I represent the respondent, Deed, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Your Honors, we're asking the court to affirm the ULJ's decision because the statute is unambiguous and the facts are undisputed. And the only result that is legally correct that may be reached in this case is the one that the ULJ reached. I would like to address a couple of points that counsel brought up in his argument just now, and then I'll move on to the other points I wanted to make. So one theme that recurs in counsel's argument in briefing and today is why would the legislature want to do this? Why would they want employees of schools to be cut off suddenly because the season has changed and it's now summer if they were previously eligible based on the loss of a job? And as Judge Reyes pointed out in questioning, that really was the point. That is the point of this provision. It creates an exception to treat school employees differently from other workers. Whether it's fair or whether it's wise to do it this way is a question for the legislature to address. Questions about fairness do not allow DEED to not apply the plain statute. And the statute is unambiguous, as this court recognized in Swanson versus Independent School District 625. That was a 1992 presidential case in which a slightly different version of the statute was at issue, but the court said this provision is unambiguous. The other issue that I wanted to address in counsel's argument was this 2017 amendment. And as we pointed out in our brief, the 2017 amendment took out several anys that appeared in front of words in the statute. But as we argued in our brief, the amendment did not change the meaning or the substance of the statute. And there's a Senate council report that went along with those amendments that clarified that this is merely a clarification. This is not a substantive change to the statute. And the statute as currently written can only be read in one way. So I'll just walk through that. There are five questions essentially that the statute asks. One is, did this applicant work for an educational institution or institutions during their base period? If the answer is yes, then we move on to the second question, which is this person seeking unemployment benefits for a week that falls within the summer break between school years? If the answer to that is yes, we move on to the third step, which is, did this applicant work for an educational institution or institutions in the prior academic year? There's no connection between this third question and the first question. The employment in the prior academic year does not have to be the same employment that they had in the base period. So the answer again in Ms. Hussain's case is yes, she worked for an educational institution in the 2020-2021 academic year. And then the next question is, has this person received a reasonable assurance of employment with an educational institution or institutions? Again, doesn't have to be the same one that they worked for previously for the following academic year. Again, the answer from Ms. Hussain is yes. And then the final question, the fifth question is the employment offered for the subsequent academic year substantially less favorable than what they had in the prior academic year? Again, the comparison under the plain language of the statute has to be between the two successive academic years' employment. The comparison cannot be between the upcoming employment for the next academic year and the base period employment.
So if I may, this gets back to one of my questions with Mr. Atmore. So, understanding your focus on they've got to be successive academic years, you would agree with me that, look, this could be very well be different if we're talking about the summer of 2020, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. You are correct. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Right. Okay. I just want to make sure we're agreeing on that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I will address that quickly because that's also a point that was made in counsel's brief. She did receive benefits for the summer of 2020, and the summer of 2020 was different for the exact same reason that you pointed out, Judge Justin. For the summer of 2020, she was in a different situation. For the year immediately preceding the summer of 2020, she had two jobs. And for the next academic year, after the summer of 2020, she expected to have only one of those jobs. And the loss was substantial. I mean, she lost, I think, a job that paid about $130 a week is what it appears from the exhibits. It was a tech support worker job.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead, counsel.
So for that summer, she did not have reasonable assurance of employment that would be similar. It would be substantially less favorable, and that's why she was eligible for the summer of 2020.
So as I understand counsel, and I'm sure he'll correct me if I'm wrong about this on rebuttal, you know, he's saying, look, when you look at subdivision 7, you're talking about employment. We should read that as individual jobs. And, you know, because this is a different situation where someone had originally had two jobs. And so we ought to do one analysis for one job and one analysis for the other job. You know, so maybe at a high level, I think I understand this argument. And if you could reasonably read employment to be an individual job, then doesn't that make the statute ambiguous? And while you were saying we don't look at absurdity or the impact of interpretations, we do. If the statute's ambiguous, right? We can then look and say, well, is this an absurd result? Does this, what are the, the outcomes of each, reasonable outcomes of each interpretation? So could you address the ambiguity question for us?
Sure, Your Honor. So the term employment is defined in Minnesota statutes, chapter 268. It is defined at 268.035 subdivision 15A. And it's defined not in terms of a particular role or working in a particular capacity, but merely as the relationship between an employer and an employee. So it distinguishes services performed in employment from services performed as an independent contractor. So it uses the language, I believe, master-servant role or something of that sort. The focus is on services performed. Now, I disagree with counsel respectfully about his interpretation of the term employment in 268.085 subdivision 7. Because if you look at the first sentence of the provision, I think it becomes clear that the term employment does not refer to a single position or a single job. And I will read that real quick. So paragraph A of 268.085 subdivision 7 reads, wage credits from employment with an educational institution or institutions may not be used for unemployment benefit purposes. And then it goes on. So when we're talking about employment with an educational institution or institutions, I think that makes clear that the term employment can encompass multiple jobs. And we're looking at all of the wage credits together. And then when we look at the next provision, which talks about successive academic years, it says the person had employment in the previous academic year and has reasonable assurance of employment in the next academic year. Again, there's no modifier there. It doesn't say had that employment or the same as the base period employment in the previous academic year. It doesn't say that. And that's, I think, where the confusion comes in for me too, because I don't see how we can get to the outcome that Ms. Hussain seeks in this case, given the language of the statute as it is written. I also wanted to address the argument that counsel makes about Ms. Hussain being unemployed. That term has a particular purpose in the unemployment insurance statutes. It appears in the eligibility criteria. So a person must be unemployed in any given week in order to be eligible for benefits for that week. And the term unemployed is defined at 268.035 subdivision 26. It has two prongs. To be unemployed, you must have worked less than 32 hours in a week, and you must have earnings from that work that are less than your weekly unemployment benefit amount. The term unemployment doesn't even care if you are an employee. If you look at the definition of unemployed in 268.035, it says you could have performed 32 or more hours of services in volunteer work, and that makes you not unemployed for that week. Or you could have performed 32 or more hours of services as an independent contractor or as a self-employed person. That also makes you not unemployed. So the terms employment and unemployed don't have that tight relationship that counsel tries to argue they have. They simply don't inform each other's interpretation in the way that that counsel argues they do. The other point, and I won't spend too much time on this, but it's arguable whether Ms. Hussain was even technically unemployed during the academic year 2020-2021. She was working less than 32 hours a week, certainly we can see that, but it appears that she did not report any earnings to the unemployment insurance program for that calendar or for that academic year, other than the $20 COVID hazard pay that she received per shift. She did not consider her housing, the cash value of her housing at the U of M as earnings, even though indeed would take the position that those should have been reported as earnings, and they likely would have exceeded her weekly unemployment benefit amount, which was $109 at the time. But that point is neither here nor there. I
just want to make sure that point is neither here nor there, counsel, because I would really not want to take away the implication that because someone, you know, exercises their rights, including the right to a certiorari appeal, the deed is going to go back and examine something like this. Just in this situation, I would like to have your comment on that.
So, Your Honor, the only reason this information even came to light was through this appeal process at the Court of Appeals.
And I would just say, speaking on my behalf, not on behalf of the panel, that I would have real concerns if, you know, because from, you know, one perspective, that someone appeals and, you know, exercises their rights, that the indeed goes back and looks and, you know, scrutinizes and tries to decide whether their overpayments are their overpayments or incorrect reporting. That just deeply concerns me. I will say no more about that, but move on to an additional question.
And that question. I understand your concern, Judge. And there has not been any determination made that she was not unemployed or that she had earnings that she
I will say nothing more about it. I've expressed my serious concern. Right. If I could turn to an issue that was briefed but not addressed on the appellant's argument, and that's a duty of a ULJ to assess any applicability of Executive Order 20-05. You know, certainly ULJs have obligations to assist employees, you know, during these hearings. Why wouldn't that? And I understand on the New York case, that case dealt with deadlines. We're not talking about deadlines here, but I'm really talking about the overall obligation of ULJ to assist employees and why that wouldn't extend to assessing whether or not there was, not saying there was or wasn't, EO implications here.
Certainly, Your Honor. So this court's holding in Merak, as I'm sure you are aware, the holding was that substantial compliance was suspended for the appeal provision in 268.101. And to get to that conclusion, of course, the court reasoned that substantial compliance, strict compliance was suspended for Chapter 268 generally, and not just for specific provisions named in the executive order. Deed's position is that Merak's holding and the executive order do not mean that strict compliance is suspended with each and every single provision within Chapter 268. It is suspended for certain provisions, and substantial compliance is the standard for those provisions for the duration of the peacetime emergency, but not for every single provision. And in trying to make substantial compliance work with the educational wage provision that's at issue here, it just does not seem to me that the governor's intent with the executive order was to suspend strict compliance with this provision, because it's simply not workable to apply substantial compliance.
And my question was narrower than that, counsel.
Sure.
It was really about the duty of the ULJ to basically address, make that assessment you're talking about, and maybe, you know, and to, you know, as part of the duty to assist employees. So that's my very much more narrowly framed question.
Certainly, Your Honor. As we argued in our brief, because Merak's holding did not on its face appear to extend to a provision like this one, and because of the difficulties you run into when you try to apply the substantial compliance provision, it becomes clear pretty quickly that this provision maybe doesn't work with substantial compliance. And I gave an example of that in footnote 79 of our brief. When there is nothing for the applicant to do under this provision, then how do you ask the question, have you taken steps to comply with the statute? Or do you have a reasonable explanation for failing to comply with the statute? And I think that's where the difficulty comes in. So I don't believe the ULJ erred in that regard. But regardless, if this court believes that it was error for the ULJ to not address it, certainly all the facts, again, are undisputed and the legal standard can be applied de novo. So I would take the position that with respect to this provision specifically, substantial compliance is not the standard for the peacetime emergency, because it, and I see my time is up, so if I could just finish my sentence.
You may.
Thank you. When we apply the principles of statutory interpretation under Minnesota Statute 645.17, courts must presume that, or may presume that, the legislature does not intend results that are impossible to execute. And we would argue that it is impossible to make the substantial compliance standard work with a provision like this one, because there is no action for the applicant in this case to take. So it doesn't make sense to ask, did you take steps, or did you have a reasonable explanation for not doing what you were supposed to do? And with that, I would rest and ask that you affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll turn now back to appellant. You have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. Let me go to one of the main points that we've all been discussing here, and that is that this is a subdivision, a statutory section that is intended to treat certain types of employees differently. No dispute as to that. The problem I have with it is the reading the deed is putting on this subdivision is treating two similar employees differently. There's no dispute that this is work for an educational institution. But here, one employee of that institution would be treated differently than another if you accepted deed's interpretation. And that just doesn't make sense. It's the inverse of what's intended by Subdivision 7. Because Subdivision 7 says, essentially, there's no unemployment between breaks in summer breaks. You don't have unemployment. But we have unemployment here. She was unemployed and remained unemployed. And so if you imply it, if you enforce it the way that deed is interpreting it, it's the opposite of what was intended. Because someone who actually is unemployed is not getting benefits. And that doesn't make any sense. And so there's no disagreement that this treats school employees differently than everybody else and is intended to. My point is, their reading treats two different school employees differently. And so to make it all work, you have to look at each job separately. Yes.
Would you agree that the tech support position that your client had ended before the start of the 2020 to 2021 academic year?
Ended before the start of the... Yes.
Okay. In that case, as I read subdivision 7, sub A, sub 1, and it says the applicant had employment for an educational institution or institutions in the prior academic year or term, that's where I'm having some difficulty seeing how your argument can be successful, because we're talking about unemployment benefits that weren't paid in the summer of 2021. Correct. Mm-hmm. So why does the fact that if you want to, if we accept your premise that we should evaluate each job separately, why does that not end the inquiry, essentially? Why do we not find that deed, in fact, is correct in looking at that and saying that that employment that ended before the beginning of the 2020-2021 academic year does not qualify, does not lead to her being qualifying for the unemployment benefits for that next summer.
Right. So that again goes to what does the word employment mean? What does the subdivision mean when it talks about employment? Because if it's any employment, and by the way, they removed any in 2017, they took that word out. If it's any employment, I'm going to have to agree with you, right? I have no choice. If employment means any job, if you got multiple jobs, doesn't matter. You suddenly are cut off once the seasons change. But it can't mean that. Employment has to mean each of the jobs. You have to look at each of the jobs separately. And so my point is, and I'm looking at the statute. That's why I'm looking away. I apologize, but the statute has to be read consistently with everything else in 268. And again, it just creates the inverse of what this was intended to do. If you say her unemployment status was suddenly no longer there, she remained unemployed from March 2020 right through 2021. And she was getting the benefits, but nothing changed. Nothing changed. She didn't get a job. She didn't get another job. Nothing changed. And then she's suddenly cut off for the benefits by application of this statute, which I think that was misapplied, because employment has to mean each job. Which job are you looking at? And so that's how I would answer that, Judge.
And so then how do you respond to Ms. Humayun's position on the definition of employment and what the implication of institution or institutions is?
I think it creates an ambiguity. Employment with an educational, I see my time is up, Your Honor, if I may continue. Thank you. Employment with an educational institution or institutions. And then they repeat that phrase in sub one, A1. I don't think it really changes the analysis. It talks about multiple jobs. Potentially you could be a professor at one place and a professor at another. And if you have a job, I think you still have my analysis. You still have my problem regardless. Because if you lose one of them, I think you should be entitled to benefits if you're defined as unemployed as the statute defines it. So that's how I would answer that. And before I close, I did want to apologize. I did not include the ULJ's decisions in my addendum. That was an oversight. Apologize to court and counsel for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel.